Today, a different way to read a psalm, a different way to see ourselves.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So we're going to take a look at the third psalm today. I'm personally working through the book of Psalms and on my way through up through a few more psalms than this, up in the teens somewhere. But the third psalm particularly broke me of an old habit. As I came to understand what the psalm was about, saw it in its context, which is, by the way, provided for us in this psalm. Not all of them have that, but this one does. Once I saw this psalm in its context, I realized I had to read it a way I never had before. I had to read it from a perspective that I had never even considered before, and it changed everything about my understanding, not only in this psalm, but now about how I read the other psalms as well. And so if you are a believer who has relied on the psalms like I have, then I strongly encourage you to try to hang in there through the end of this study. It's not a long psalm, but we'll need to go through it two or three times to get the idea of where the transition happens in our thinking. But then also, if you're not that familiar with the Psalms, if you've never really relied on them yourselves, then the lesson that's built into this psalm is a really beautiful conveyance of what the message of Christianity altogether, the message of Judaism to begin with, is really all about. And I want us to be able to see that clearly. And so our first step would simply be to read through this psalm, beginning with that opening line that's above verse 1 in the English text, but really is a part of the psalm. So it's the title, A Psalm of David, when he fled from Absalom, his son. We kind of know that story in our background, but I'll tell some of that story as we're talking through the psalm in a moment. So A Psalm of David, when he fled from Absalom, his son. O Lord, verse 1, how many are my foes? How many are rising against me? Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, in verse 3, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. Verse 5, I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, in verse 7, he says, O Lord, save me, my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. And then finally, verse 8, salvation belongs to the Lord. And then this statement that really transforms the meaning when you understand where he's coming from. The final statement, your blessing be on your people. Those are the eight verses of Psalm 3 that we have to talk about. And we'll come back and talk about why he would say that he wants God to break the teeth of the wicked. I know it sounds like an awful thing to wish on someone, and it is. It's a curse. It's there for a reason. But there is a good reason for him to have said it, especially in the context that he gives us of writing this psalm when he fled from Absalom, his son. So, you know, on the first reading of a psalm like this, our response is automatic. We identify ourselves with the psalmist. After all, he penned it for us, wrote it down so that we could see the words that he himself lifted up before God and then repeat them on behalf of our need when we find ourselves in a crisis. And so the first way we read it is the way David would have read it to the Lord to begin with. But we read it according to our circumstance. So first, you know, we have some kind of overwhelming opposition. And so we say with David, Lord, how many are my foes in these first couple of verses? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. And it makes sense that we would do this. Nothing wrong with this. And so we identify ourselves with David being persecuted. And when we're persecuted, we say, Lord, see how many people are against me. And then we find our hope in the Lord, just like David does. So we say, Lord, just like David, you, Lord, are a shield around me. You're my glory and the lifter of my head. So I cried aloud to the Lord, just like I am now, by reading this psalm that David gave me so that I could identify with him and pray to you. And you answered me from your holy hill, as we say it. And then we describe the deliverance that God provides for us. So I lay down and slept. I woke again because the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. We pray to the Lord, just like you provided for David. You allowed him to sleep. You allowed me to sleep. And I'm not afraid of anybody. And I find my deliverance, my salvation in you, because you are my deliverer. So just like David, you are his deliverer, you're my deliverer. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, because you strike all my enemies on the cheek and you break the teeth of the wicked. Again, an expression that I'll address in just a moment. And then finally conclude by giving a blessing to you, Lord, because you've delivered me just like you delivered David, and because I know you'll deliver others when they call on you just like I did, just like David. Salvation belongs to the Lord, your blessing beyond your people. But then let's go back and put it actually in the context of what David himself was experiencing when he wrote this psalm, because we all know the story. And if you don't, I'll help you recall some parts of the story of when David fled from Absalom, his son. And this starts out around 2 Samuel 15. And when I say starts, I mean we're picking it up in the middle, but the exciting part of the story, the fleeing part of the story, starts in 2 Samuel 15, when a messenger comes to David. He's fleeing and says to him, the hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom. So, you know, what is it that brings that to pass? Well, there's a conspiracy that's growing. And so as it grows strong, this messenger is going to come tell David about it. But it says the people are with Absalom, and they are growing in number because Absalom wants to rebel against his father and take over the kingdom for the cause of a long story that we won't go into today, but has to do with David's prior generosity and also David's prior sinfulness, both. And as a result of that, Absalom ends up in this privileged position, which he then turns against the father that had actually provided for him the grace or the mercy to be able to live instead of die after some of his own responses to sins, which he had enacted then because David had been more gracious than he wanted David to be then as well. So anyway, the point is that Absalom has now started gathering this following who he's going to use in an insurrection against David. And so when David says, Lord, how many are my foes? In the first verse, many are rising against me. It is literally true. When he's writing this on his way out of Jerusalem, it's because he now has discovered that the hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom, and it's because that conspiracy against him under Absalom has grown strong, as 2 Samuel chapter 15 says, and the people with Absalom keep increasing. There are just more and more of them. And so as David leaves, this is what happens. So he says in verse 2 of this psalm that we're reading, it says, many are saying of my soul, there's no salvation for him in God. And that's what David experienced on the way out of the city. So remember, David had taken the kingdom from Saul's family, not from Saul. He never rebelled against Saul, but he took the kingdom when Jonathan didn't take the kingdom as Saul's son, and of course he died too. But he had already committed the kingdom to David. So David takes the kingdom. Well, all of Saul's family, anybody related to Saul, was questioning whether David should really be their king or not. And so part of David establishing his throne was making sure that people recognized his authority. So when he's thrust out of Jerusalem by his own son, Absalom, this man named Shimei meets him on the trail and curses him, saying, get out, you man of blood, because this relative of Saul sees the opportunity to relish his enemy's fall, David's fall. And so Shimei says, as he curses, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you. You are a man of blood. So David is facing this onslaught, not only of direct insurrection, opposition of people who want to throw him out of the throne, but people who are glad he's being thrown out of the throne. There's no salvation for you in God. You deserve what's coming to you, you man of blood. That's in the first two verses. That's what David is experiencing. Then, when we get to the next little section in verses 3 and 4, where David is saying in the prayer, as he's writing it for us, you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head. This is an expression that's used when you're approaching Jerusalem, but Jerusalem is a hill surrounded by other valleys and then hills around those valleys as well, just like the Mount of Olives. And so when he says, you are the lifter of my head, there's some imagery there about how I am dejected and I am having to descend from Jerusalem, but you give me hope. You give me a reason to turn my head back up to the hills from whence comes my help. And so I cried aloud to the Lord in verse 4, and he answered me from his holy hills. Because remember that when David is being thrust out of the city or fleeing the city because his son Absalom is pursuing him, the place he flees is across the brook Kidron to the Mount of Olives, exactly the same place Jesus goes when he leaves Jerusalem to go to the Mount of Olives and pray. And so in this case, and we'll come back to that in a moment, but right now, as we're seeing David exercise this departure from Jerusalem, it says, and all the land wept aloud as the people passed by, and the king, because they're grieving over their king having to flee the city, even though he has multitudes in opposition to him, David always has faithful followers. And so all the land is weeping aloud as all the people are passing by, and the king crossed the brook Kidron, fleeing from Absalom. He crossed the brook Kidron, and all the people passed on toward the wilderness. But David went up. This is in 2 Samuel 15. This particular verse is verse 30. But David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives. You lift up my head. You are the lifter of my head. You're where I turn when I have nowhere else to turn. This is how David is experiencing his life in the moment when we're told he's providing this psalm for us, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, weeping, barefoot, with his head covered. And yet, Lord, you are the lifter up of my head, with his head covered. And all the people who were with him covered their heads, and they went up weeping as they went. So David is experiencing being thrust out of his own city and the enemies opposing him. But even in that moment of grieving over having to leave the city, knows that the head he has covered in grief is being lifted up by the Lord so he can look to the hills and find his help. Now, this is just understanding the psalm as it's given to us face on, and we see ourselves identified with David, the person who's being persecuted and looking for help. But we should know how persecuted he was in this process. And so what happens when David gets out of the city, and you know how this happens, in verses 5 and 6, the psalm continues this way, I lay down and slept. I woke again because the Lord sustained me. See, he flees the city because he's being pursued by Absalom, his son, and he goes out into the woods. He goes to the Mount of Olives, out into the wilderness then, and instead of having camp all night and staying awake and worrying and strategizing and planning, he lays down and sleeps in the darkness. And the Lord awakens him, having been safe and protected all night. How does that happen? And David says, well, here's why it happened, because I'm not afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. I don't care that they have pursued me, because I know the Lord will sustain me even in my sleep. Well, do you remember the story and how this happened, that when David flees the city, Ahithophel, this great advisor and counselor, stays with Absalom and is loyal to Absalom instead of David? And Ahithophel's advice is simple. Ahithophel's advice is, let me choose 12,000 men. That's a multitude. I will not be afraid of thousands. Well, here are 12,000 men who are supposed to pursue him into the wilderness. Ahithophel says to Absalom, let me have 12,000 men, and I'll rise, and I'll pursue David tonight. So when David is writing this psalm and saying, I laid down and slept, in that moment, Ahithophel is saying to Absalom, let me pursue him with thousands of people into the woods tonight so that he perishes. That's what David is confronted with, is being faced with, and David is going to go to sleep. And Ahithophel says to Absalom, look, I'll come on him while he's weary and discouraged. The problem he has is that even when David is weary and discouraged, he has a Yahweh, a Lord, to lift up his head and to give him peace, to be able to sleep at night. But Ahithophel says to Absalom, no, let me come on him while he's weary and discouraged, and I'll throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee, and I will strike down only the king. See, I am alone. I have thousands against me, but I trust the Lord. And so I will lay down and sleep, and I'll wake up again tomorrow, and I'll be sustained. His deliverance comes from Yahweh. And again, this is just reading it straightforwardly, understanding in the context of fleeing Absalom how this psalm takes its meaning, right? So I have deliverance because the Lord is the one who provides that deliverance. So David continues the prayer in verse 7, arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, because you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. So striking them on the cheek is shaming them. Breaking the teeth of the wicked. I talked about this a long time ago when we had our radio program, and it's a long explanation to if I were to try to prove it, but I'll just say to you clearly, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, this expression, break their teeth in their mouth, means stop them from chewing on me with their words. Stop them from opposing me with their mouths. So when they're gnashing on Stephen with their teeth, they're cursing him, they're blaspheming him, they're opposing him, and saying things against him. And it's the same thing throughout the Psalms. And so when he says, break their teeth in their mouth, break the teeth of the wicked, this is what happens with Ahithophel's counsel. Because when Ahithophel, the advisor to Absalom, says, I'll take thousands, and I'll destroy this man who's fleeing and exhausted, and David is lying down and saying, Yahweh, I trust you to protect me, because even though thousands are against me, I know you will sustain me so that I can wake up in the morning. In that context, David then says, so save me, O God. Break the teeth, break the counsel of the wicked in their mouth. So how does it happen? Absalom and all the men of Israel respond not to the counsel of Ahithophel, but to the counsel of Hushai the Archite. If you've ever heard that name before, Hushai the Archite, you know this story. Hushai is a different counselor who wants to go with David. But when they're leaving the city and Hushai says, I'm coming with you, David, I'm loyal to you, David says, you would do me more good if you would stay behind with Absalom, and if you find out news, give it to these two sons who will run out and tell me the news. And even if you don't get news, you can undermine the counsel of Ahithophel, because we know he will give strong advice to Absalom on how to win this war. But maybe you can undermine that counsel. And lo and behold, the Lord breaks the teeth, breaks the words of Ahithophel, and strikes him on the cheek, embarrasses him, shames him. How does it happen? So 2 Samuel 17:14, Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai, what was his counsel? Oh, don't do what Ahithophel said. Remember, Ahithophel said, let's go out right now. David's exhausted. We'll take him in the night. We won't kill anyone else. We kill David. The battle's over. We have the city. Everything is won. That's his advice. 12,000 men, go overwhelm them while they're exhausted. Hushai says, well, I don't think that's good advice, because David is like a bear that's been separated from its cubs, and right now would be the worst time to fight this mighty man, warrior, out in the woods, and his men who are so aggressive. So let's give it some time and think about it. And he creates space for David to be able to recover and to figure out what's going on. So Absalom and all the men of Israel, they choose the counsel of Hushai, it says. This is in 2 Samuel 17, by the way. In verse 14, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel, they said, because the Lord was answering David's prayer, you know, strike all my enemies on the cheek, break the teeth of the wicked. The Lord had ordained to defeat the good teeth counsel of Ahithophel. so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. And by the way, in the next chapter, we get the result of that, what happens, because he defends David and protects him from the enemy. And so in 2 Samuel 18, when we get to the end of the story, after Absalom's been caught in a branch in the woods, when they do finally come out to try to take David, and Absalom is killed then, and then a messenger comes to bring the news, thinking that David is going to love the news. We'll talk about that in a moment, not yet. But he says, and so the people on the watchtower, you know, where David is, are watching. They're looking out to see what news might come. And this Cushite comes. And the Cushite says, "Good news for my lord the king, because the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you." See, strike all my enemies on the cheek. "The Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you." And the king said to the Cushite, "This is all I want to know. Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And the Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord," and he thinks he's only bringing good news, right? Because your enemies have been defeated. The Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you for evil be like that young man," meaning he has died. He has no idea what that's going to mean to David. We'll talk about it in a minute, because we have no idea what that means to us, which we'll talk about in just a moment as well. But then we finally, then now understanding how David has written this psalm for us, and for us to see how the Lord worked so many things to protect David in his most dire need, but to lift up his head so that he had hope and provide deliverance through the deliverer, through Yahweh himself, breaking the counsel of the wicked against him, so that David would respond in verse 8, of course, by saying, "Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people." Now, that's the first way that we read the psalm. This is the straightforward prima facie, right, way that we read the psalm. It's just David called out for help when he was in desperate need and God provided for him. "When I have desperate need, I'll call out to God for help and he'll provide for me." And so I'll repeat this psalm as David praying it, but now it's me instead of David. Fine. But it's not just David. David, and because David is the anointed one, because he's the king, because he is the type of the Messiah that's present, that's what it means to be the anointed one. And when I say type, I just mean because Christ is the ultimate reality of the genuine anointed Messiah who comes to actually bring redemption and salvation to everyone. But David is that in the Old Testament for Israel. He is their deliverer. He is the anointed one. He's their Messiah. So what David experiences, Israel is experiencing. That's why the land is crying out. So Moses goes to Pharaoh after he spent his time in the desert and God sends him back to deliver the people, this is what the Lord says that Moses has to say to Pharaoh. "You shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord." Now, get this. "Israel is my firstborn son. And I say to you, let my son go so that he can serve me." And in Exodus 5, the response, Moses says to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go so that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." It is God's relationship with his son is not just with David, but with Israel. That's the point, so that the people of God are able to pray this prayer. Now, that makes perfect sense of how we read it. We identify with David, but understand that they also, Israel, as a nation, they also identify with David as he's fleeing the city. Because while the insurrection is taking place, those who are faithful, all the people, the exact wording was, all the people who were with him when he's going down to the Brook Kidron and up into the Mount of Olives, where Jesus goes later, which we'll read about in a moment, all those people who were with him covered their heads and they went up weeping as they went. So when David says at the end of the prayer, so in verse 8, "Salvation belongs to the Lord, your blessing be on your people," and then he ends the prayer with the blessing on your people, that's the part that we do recognize. Oh, Lord, bless your people. And now we take license to read the psalm and say, oh, well, this is a blessing to God's people. I'm God's people, so if David prayed it, I can pray it. That applies to me. All of that is absolutely true and fair and valuable and useful, and we should rely on it as one way to pray this prayer. And it completely ignores the most important message in the psalm, which we'll get to in just a moment. Now we take what is the most important turn in this psalm. And it's one that I found that I myself, now maybe this is not true of you, but I myself have ignored in every psalm I've ever read because I identified myself gladly with David, but for some reason never said to myself, am I the David in this psalm? Am I the good people of Israel who followed him out of Jerusalem through the brook Kidron to the Mount of Olives? Or is it possible that I could be Absalom in this psalm, that I'm supposed to see myself there? In which case you would say, well, what good would that do? I mean, then you don't have anything to get from the psalm, really? Because as I understand it, I have a mediator who prays for me in heaven. I have someone else who's interceding on my behalf. And so as I'm reading the story, I'm thinking, well, let's just take at least this step, because if we know that it's true that God refers to his people, Israel, as his firstborn son, and we know that something powerful is happening with David, that he grieves so dearly over the loss of the son that ran him out of his own city, that chased him off of his own throne. We'll read more of that in just a moment. Then maybe we should understand something different about what happens with Jesus, who David is simply foreshadowing, right? I mean, there's no doubt that in the Old Testament, David is foreshadowing what Jesus himself does for us. And so when we're reading about David having to flee from Absalom, his son, we recognize that this is one king saying, no, this is my throne city. This is my rule, my authority, and not yours. I'm going to run you out of the city. This is exactly how the disciples describe what happened to Jesus when the authorities who were in Jerusalem chase him out of the city. I mean, they lead him out of the city to crucify him because they want to own the city. They want their authority reinforced. This is what the disciples are saying in Acts 4:27 when they're giving their answer, they're giving their message about why, what they're doing. When they do that and that they're thrown into prison and they're told not to preach in the name of Jesus anymore, and then they gather together and they pray, what do they pray? They say, truly in this city, there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. This is the word that's used for David in the Old Testament, the anointed one. Against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, the authorities of those cities, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel. The disciples actually bring into the story about Jesus being cast out of Jerusalem the fact that the very people of Israel, not just the Gentiles, not just the kings among the Gentiles, but the people of Israel themselves were running him out of the city in order to crucify him. And we know to bring about ultimately whatever his hand, God's hand, and his plan had predestined to take place as they finish that part of the prayer. But this is what happens to, he's chased out of the city by Israel, just like we were talking about David being chased out, not just by Absalom, but by the people of Israel who have sided with Absalom and chosen to go against him. So when we describe in the first couple of verses, David's overwhelming opposition and how they say there's no salvation for him in God, we recognize this is the kind of language, the same thing that Shimei had been saying to David. These are the things that the people on the ground are saying to Jesus while he's being crucified in Matthew 27. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, I am the Son of God. They're saying, is God going to deliver him? Of course not. There's no salvation for him in God. Jesus experiences exactly the same thing in Jerusalem. And when David finds his hope in the Lord, who will deliver him? Well, this is where, obviously, Jesus finds his hope. When he had spoken these words in the upper room with the disciples, it says he lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, as he anticipates his crucifixion, Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify. You are the lifter up of my head. That's what this amounts to. Since you have given him authority over all flesh to give eternal life to all whom you have given to him. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron. Those are the words John gives to it right after Jesus says, lift up, I'm lifting up my eyes to you so that you will lift me up, so that you will be glorified. Then it says in chapter 18, verse 1, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, following exactly the path that David is taking to go up the Mount of Olives, with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Remember, David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot and with his head covered. And then when David lays down to sleep in verses 5 and 6, and says, I will not be afraid, even though there are thousands who oppose me. Of course, we realize the disciples all flee Jesus. They all forsake him, and they flee in Mark 14, for instance. And when David is saying, arise, O Lord, save me, O my God. You strike all my enemies on the cheek. Remember, this is the prayer. If we're reading now for David to be saying these things as the Messiah, then David is praying it to say, O Lord, save me, strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked to deliver himself and Israel from those who opposed God's ordained one, God's anointed one. What does the anointed one say, Christ, when he faces the crucifixion? My Father, if it is possible, deliver me. Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, he tacks on, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. His prayer is still for deliverance. The Messiah himself, Jesus, let this cup pass from me. I submit to your will. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. But the prayer of deliverance is present. And when he says, not as I will, but as you will, what is the Father's will? What is that will that would be realized? Well, remember the last words in David's prayer? Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. What is the Father's will? To deliver his people, to bless his people. But wait, we're not there yet. Do you get this? Who are his people? Who are his people? The people he's praying for to be delivered are the people who are chasing him out of the city where he is begging God to be his deliverer, where he is lamenting on the way up the Mount of Olives. How could that be? Because the Messiah always lays down his life to make a way for the very people who are trampling over him to find their way to God. It's what always happens. And this is why when we read that story about, you know, in the book of Acts, the prayer in the book of Acts, this is why Jesus is dying for the people who are crucifying him, why he gives his life for the people who are crucifying him. And it's why when we're reading in Exodus 4, the Lord describes his firstborn son as Israel, these people who are rejecting Moses, who are opposing Moses, which Stephen points out, by the way, in Acts 7 when he recounts the story. The point is that once we recognize that the firstborn son is how God identifies Israel and how he identifies the Messiah, and that they're identified together, that there's no separating them, so that when the messenger comes to David in this really weird part of the story that we find uncomfortable, when the messenger comes to David and says, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be just like that young man. What is David's response? How does he answer this great good news The king, in verse 33, was deeply moved. You remember this. It's one of the saddest verses in the Bible. The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate for this son who was trying to kill him, who wanted to hunt him down in the woods and kill him so he could take the throne from him. Just exactly like Israel, the firstborn son of God, had chased him out of Jerusalem so that they could kill him and take the throne from him. For that son, for Absalom, for that son, those people who chased him out of the city and put him on a cross, Jesus prays, nevertheless, not my will, but yours. David prays, your blessing be on your people. What people? The ones who are chasing me out of the city. So why does he respond this way for Absalom? Here's the statement. The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber. He's just found out the person who was trying to kill you is dead. May all your enemies be this way. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom. This is not accidental language. This is not a quirk of David's personality. This is not a weakness of his being too compassionate. This is what it means to be the Messiah. It's what it means for us to be as much the Messiah as David is. Are you offended by that language? Because it's what it means to be a Christian. Little Christs. We are the people called to be what Christ is. We are supposed to care about the people the same way Christ does, the same way David did for the very man who was trying to kill him. The king was so deeply moved that he said, oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son. He laments so aggrieved, that his own army, his own generals are coming to him and saying, you act like if all of us had died and Absalom had lived, everything would have been okay. They missed the entire point. He's not for Absalom and against them. He's not for them and against Absalom. He is Israel. He is the king of Israel. He is the nation's leader, anointed one. And to lose any is to lose everything that he's trying to redeem. And so in exactly the same way that Christ is grieving over the very nation that is chasing him to the cross, David is doing that in this psalm. And we read the psalm only hearing ourselves saying, why are my enemies chasing me? And not recognizing that it's what we ignore is our culpability. Not recognizing that we are the ones who chased Christ to the cross, chased David out of the city, who deserved what Absalom finally faced, but who had a king who would grieve over us like David did his son, like Christ does the people, all people, because he dies for all of us so that he can give us redemption. And if and when we remember our culpability, because we see the opposition against us. We know who's opposed to us. Oh, Lord, I'm facing these enemies. And they're real. They're real enemies. I'm not saying it to make fun of it. I'm saying it's so easy for us to carry this burden to the Lord. Oh, Lord, these people are against me. Please stop them and rescue me, deliver me. So we see the opposition. We see our imprecations against them. Lord, curse them for this and that, for doing so much wickedness. How can people be that way? We see our deliverance when God reaches down and snatches us out of the destruction that was coming our way. All of that's easy. We see our opposition. We see the imprecations, the curses on those who are against us. We see the deliverance, but we forget our culpability. We forget that we were his enemy. We forget that we have failed to do what he called us to do. We forget that we have betrayed people, much less God. We forget that we have been unfaithful. And because we forget our culpability, we also forget our calling. The calling which David fulfills and Jesus fulfilled. The calling we realize when we understand that when we were culpable for putting Christ on the cross, he prayed for our redemption. That is, that God made us, when we were his enemies, his family. And we're invited to do exactly, commanded to do exactly that same thing. So once we remember, David's grieving is not some side story about Absalom. It's the point of the story, that David is fleeing the city from a man who is pursuing his death so that he can take over the city. And all the while, David is praying for that man and the people who are with him to be blessed by Yahweh, not just destroyed, but to be blessed. They are his people. They are Israel, the men of Israel. The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom. That's what they say. Not just these treasonous people, not just these traitors, not just these Gentiles who have infected us, but the men of Israel. Once we remember David's grieving for Absalom, Jesus weeping over the city that he already knows, his disciples have told him outright, and he knows it's true, that once we see David grieving for Absalom, once we see Jesus grieving for Jerusalem, we should remember that the Messiah always lays down his life to make a way for the very people who are trampling over him to find their way to God. And remember our calling to love our enemies.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.